All right, everyone. So this is James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems, and welcome back to another Bike James podcast. This podcast, I've got a very special guest. I'm very privileged to have him take the time to share his knowledge with us today. I've got Coach Tony Blauer on with us. Coach, how's it going today?
I'm good, man. Good to see you again.
Yeah, no, thanks for taking the time. For people that don't know, Coach Blauer is a combative self-defense expert. Kind of depends on what circles you run in, would depend upon what term you would use with that. But he has over four decades of experience working in self-defense, combat sports, with military and law enforcement. So to say that he's got a lot of experience is putting it mildly. But one of the things that I really liked when I heard him present at a recent workshop that I went to was how he's really dialed in the mindset and the physiology behind these things, and then, you know, how these things can apply to a self-defense situation. But he also understands how these things can apply to a broader sense, which is something I wanted to have him come on and talk about. So, but before we jump into all that, Coach, I've heard your origin story, for lack of a better term, a couple times, and I really like it because, again, you didn't necessarily grow up wanting to be a combatives and self-defense expert, but it was something that you found yourself, taking on and doing it. So the story to get to that point, I find pretty fascinating. So yeah, if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit about your background and kind of how you've got to where you're at today.
Yeah, sure, man. Most of your audience, I would imagine, are really into mountain biking and cycling and stuff like that. Some of them may be thinking, well, what the hell, you're like self-defense guy. And I'm sure there's probably, because it hasn't come up, more than one or two dozen stories of confrontations between motor vehicles and cyclists, problems on trails, with people like stopping and talking at an intersection and causing an accident, weirdos in the woods, and I bet there's way more going on than anyone knows about, because nobody talks about it. It wouldn't come up. So I wouldn't be surprised if you did get some, holy shit, like I had this happen, or I worry about this. So hopefully we can preemptively influence future events with some of the stuff there. But like you said, understanding how fear afflicts performance became like a serendipitous benefit to me studying how to manage violence. And I grew up in the 60s, I'm 61 now, and I don't know why I say that all the time, but I just give just so that if I make some movie references or some TV, people go, how old is this guy? He's 61. But it's just perspective. And I always was afraid of every sport. I always was afraid of, let me qualify that. I wasn't afraid of the sports. I was an avid athlete, and I was skilled. I mean, I could play every sport. I was natural at everything. I didn't excel at any one thing, but I was afraid to compete, and I was afraid to let down other people. You know, I emphasize that a lot because that was something that was unique in that if I was in a team situation, I didn't want to let down the team. If I was, you know, if my mom or dad took me to a race, I was skiing, but I didn't want to fall or lose because I didn't want them to be upset. For some reason, I would think that way. And it affected my enjoyment and experience along the way, to the point where, you know, if you repeat any behavior enough, that becomes your belief system. It just becomes part of, you know, your internal narrative. But the origin story, and there were a couple. One was getting jumped when I was 12 years old by two guys, and I wasn't hurt, physically hurt. And I went home and told my dad, you know, hey, I got jumped by two guys after baseball today. And because I didn't have a black eye, I didn't have a broken nose, he made some joke, I think, like, was it a pillow fight or something like that, you know, like, ha ha ha. But it was 1973-ish. Bruce Lee had just passed away. There was one Taekwondo school that opened up near us, about a mile or so away. And it was like, okay, you're going to learn self-defense. And when I got there and I started training, I fell in love instantly. It was like, I almost felt like this was what was going to save me and fix me in terms of all the fear stuff. It didn't, but it started that journey, that deep journey into self-defense. What I didn't realize at the time, and I might not have mentioned it at the workshop that you did, but in the 60s, growing up when TV was black and white, or if your family was middle class, you might have had a color TV, but shows were going from black and white to color. You know, the top shows were all, they wouldn't be considered violent by any standard today, but they were all like action shows. Mannix, The Streets of San Francisco, The Green Hornet, The Wild Wild West, and things that some of you, if you're older, go, I remember that show, but most of you listening going, wow, how old is this guy? Black and white TV, what the hell? But all the shows had fighting in. And it was really like, it was shitty fighting. It wasn't at all, you know, like if I played a fight now, you'd go, wow, that's the worst choreography ever. But it was the 60s, right? But I would watch these shows all the time. And I didn't realize it until I started practicing martial arts, that I was drawn to, almost glued to the TV when I'd watch these shows. When there was a fight scene, there could have been a fire in the house, and I'd be like at the TV going like this with my mom screaming, the house is on fire, get out. I'd be like, I was in a bubble when I'd watch violence being handled properly, effectively. So that's really, you know, I mean, I could go on and on for hours on it, but that's really the genesis was, I think, the 60s, where I would watch these masculine, you know, leaders in the TV show. Of course, they were all men back in the 60s. There'd be a problem, they'd solve the problem. They try to be nice until it was time to not be nice, to quote Roadhouse. And then they would, you know, whether it was Bruce Lee or James West or somebody, there was always like some bad guy got knocked out. And I think what attracted me most to it was like these people appear to have no fear. And then when it was time to do the right thing, they did the right thing. And that, I was like, wow, if I could have that, I guess all these other things would go away, because, you know, nobody's trying to beat me up. When I used to compete skiing and wrestling and gymnastics, nobody's trying to, you know, beat me up. Of course, in wrestling they were, but you get the idea. Anyways, I started training. I was a fanatic about it. I think I worked out 7 days a week. I went to every class I could make. When it came time to compete and stuff like that, I had the same jitters and fear that I did in all the other sports. So it's like, when's this going to go away? And, but I was showing up. So I was putting in the work, but I was still burdened by and consumed by, what's this negative mindset? Like, why do I, you know, like, why am I so scared before this event? And it burdened me. And then when I started teaching, you know, in 1980, I got asked to teach a 15-year-old kid who was having a bully issue. I was 20, and I was so excited to do it. I'd continued my martial art training and practice, and I was coaching tennis and skiing and stuff like that. I loved helping people, so it was natural for me. And I, of course, was a fanatic about the training. But what did I taught? I'd been boxing. I'd done Wing Chun. I was doing some of Bruce Lee's Jeet Kune Do, you know, through books and Taekwondo for years. Wrestling. So I was doing an improvised version of mixed martial arts just because I was blending. And Mitch got dropped in his confrontation 3 months after I started training him. And I was like, holy shit. Like, I trained this guy for 3 months and he's still got sucker punched in this confrontation. And when I had him debrief what happened, he went, oh, we got in a fight, you know, arguing in school, and the kid shoved him, and Mitch grabbed him and pushed him against the locker bank. And Mitch is telling me the story, because then he hit me with a left hook and it knocked me down. And I said, well, you know, why didn't you slip it? Why didn't you block it? And I asked, like, why didn't you do any of the stuff that I taught you? He goes, well, I was holding his shirt and I had my school books in my other hand. If you can picture that, are you guys releasing video or just audio on the podcast?
No, yeah, I'll be posting this video.
Oh, cool. So if you're looking at me, you know, if you and I are arguing and I go, hey, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, and we're shoving each other, you know, you can move. If I take a swing, your hands can come up, you can block, you can counter. But imagine if I made you start a fight with me where you grabbed my shirt and you had like your school bag in one hand, how easy would it be for me to hit you? And that's what the kid did. The other kid, whack, hit him with a left hook, and it was done. And the first thing that went through my head when that happened was, oh my God, we teach self-defense wrong. I was 1980, I was 20 years old. And I said it collectively, James, like I said it like all self-defense, because I was an avid practitioner and study of all stuff. And all training started with how do you get out of a headlock? How do you get out of a lapel grab? What do you do if a guy's got a knife? What do you do if a guy's got a gun? And the training would start there. And it never took into account, what's the scenario? Who are you with? What's going on emotionally, psychologically at the time? Are you scared of this person? Did it happen out of the blue? And all of these factors distract us from accessing our complex motor skills. I was just on a meeting with a federal prison group that I train overseas, and they were talking about how until they started training with me, they would have all these assaults on their prison guards, and they couldn't figure out why they were happening because they were trained what to do. And so, well, you're not educating anyone on the emotional, psychological pre-fight stages. So if I jump into like a mountain biking metaphor scenario, when you get to the hill and you get to the run or the race or the whatever you're doing, you have your bike and you have your cleats and you have your legs and you have your eyes and you have your body and you have your endurance and your stamina. You know how to ride a bike. How do things go wrong then in a race or on a trail if you've got all the assets when you showed up? Because the thing that people are missing in any activity is the pre-fight, the emotional, psychological, my self-talk, my self-awareness. You need critical thinking to manage any type of conflict, bad weather, bad position, I don't know enough about mountain biking, but I think this makes sense.
Yeah.
And so it's the same thing. At a very young age, I had that epiphany, big fancy word for light bulb moment, where I was like, holy shit. Okay, this is the problem. And that really, I had forgotten about my relationship with fear. Kind of like swept it under the carpet, but it was still there. But then when I started teaching, I noticed that every student leaned into, when I would talk about fear and managing fear, everyone seemed to go, yeah, let's talk more about that. And it kind of set me on this intuitive journey to explore that in every way I could. And the significance of me telling you the fight about Mitch losing that fight is, up until that point, training would be, okay, let's box. Okay, let's kick. Okay, let's grapple. Okay, let's hold pads. Let's hit a bag. Okay, let's spar. It was all compartmentalized and block-based training. There was no brain-based element to it. What's the scenario? No Socratic element. Why are we doing this? Okay, how do you feel about this? Which might sound touchy-feely, but really, I can remember as a competitive skier, you remember my ski story, you know, where I'm at the top of the hill, a big important race. I've already pissed, you know, five times. I want a projectile vomit. I'm so fucking nervous. It's above the tree line. I'm sweating, but it's freezing up there. And this is all physiological changes in my body preparing for the danger of the race and the excitement of the race. But nobody had ever explained to me as a young athlete what physiology was, what adrenaline was. It was all like a pat on the ass or tussle of the hair. You got this, kid. And my ski coach says to me, how do you feel, kid? And I turned to him as a 15-year-old racer and I lied to him and I said, I'm great, coach. And he goes, well, the course getting icy here, gate 50, you know, take it high and outside. Everyone's wiping out there. Got it. Well, I get past that obstacle and then I catch a tip like three gates from the end, wipe out. I was going so fast, I wiped out. Actually, I think I skid through the finish line, of course, disqualified. One of the timers on the course said, hey, kid, too bad you fell, because, you know, the guy who ultimately won the race, you're a second ahead of him when you passed. I mean, a second in a giant slalom race is a fucking significant amount. But that was the story of my competitive life of almost winning. And why was I able to circumvent that icy rut halfway through the course and then still not manage to finish? It was all fear. It was like, oh my God, I didn't wipe out yet. Holy shit, I haven't wiped out. You know, if I wiped out in every important race because I was going so hard, because I couldn't control myself, because my brain wasn't, that's that flow state that Stephen Kotler and other people who study flow, you know, talk about. And I just heard, you know, this interesting observation about task specific versus ego inspired or ego specific. Have you heard the term?
Yeah. I mean, I think I am, but I could be wrong in this instance, but I could be, but I'm interested to hear what you,
The way I interpreted it, I just heard that, maybe messing up the words, but task inspired or specific or ego inspired or specific was this, I'm doing this for you versus I'm doing this for the experience of the event. And the people who truly hit flow state are just, they're one with their bike. They're one with the bike and the trail. They're not thinking about that guy's ahead of me. I got to get, if I could stay up with, you know, anything that's motivated by that external force takes you out of that potential flow. What's interesting, and I think a conundrum, I don't know if it's been answered or not, but if you're competing, and I heard this pro surfer talk about this, that, you know, if you don't have X amount of Instagram followers and sponsors, you're not getting paid. So if you want to, you know, eat food and buy a new surfboard, you need to do well. So there's a lot of ego in the, not maybe the ego people are thinking about, not like I'm a badass ego, but like, I've got to do this for other people. I'm an entertainer. Mm-hmm. I'm a pro athlete. So it's interesting. I know this, like, I watch a lot of the UFC fights and stuff like that. And I remember thinking, you know, how different it is for some fighters when it was during the lockdown and there'd be no fans cheering.
Right. Yeah.
A lot of people need that audience, or that audience, the energy of that audience is part of what gets them going. Anyways, mm-hmm. we're down a rabbit hole, but it's a real interesting kind of like introspective study, I think, is like, why do we do things? And how that influences. That's all that self-awareness, critical thinking piece.
Yeah, no, I mean, all that, like I said, one of my big aha moments when listening to you talk on the first night, you know, you did your no fear presentation. Then the next day we got more into kind of the specifics of the self-defense system. But when I realized, like, oh, the same mindset skills, the same fear management skills that help you survive a self-defense situation are the same mindset skills that you need to be successful at life, to, you know, because you mentioned specifically, like, you know, this is the reason you don't call that girl, right? And then fear, it wastes time.
Yeah.
And that, like, that really like hit home. I was like, oh wow. Okay. So in a self-defense situation, you know, a half a second or a second from fear can be the difference between life and death, but on a bigger scale, like that can be the reason that you never live a fulfilled life because you know, you never manage to learn how to deal with that fear. And then that even transfers over to the trail because mountain biking is a dangerous sport. Like that's one of the things that people don't like to talk about in the industry is that you're out there riding on a, you know, a pedal bike on a mountain. And there's things out there that can break that bike that can certainly break you. And so right. learning how to manage that fear becomes a big part of being a better rider and a big part of my own, you know, progression. So, you know, I recognize that, but, you know, you've already kind of, you know, touched on it, but could you speak on that just a little bit more as far as like how that fear and the time relationship and how it sure. goes beyond just like the self-defense aspect?
Yeah. So, you know, the only resource we can't regenerate is time. Right. And so I had this kind of realization during one of my talks where it was like, if a fear spike could be anything, you know, you're up on a trail and all of a sudden a storm blows in and you see it's lightning and you're like, oh my God, like I'm 2 hours from safety. And this is coming in fast too. You know, whatever, any one of the dangerous situations occurs, as soon as you get a fear spike, your brain starts to embrace doubt, and doubt creates hesitation, and hesitation creates procrastination, and procrastination unchecked. If you don't have the self-awareness skills to go, aha, I'm in the fear sequence now. I'm in the fear loop sequence now. I'm starting this vortex. And this is the danger, that we start going around this wheel in our mind going, oh, fuck, oh, shit, oh, fuck, oh, shit. And we're starting to do that. And those are the actual words you have to say or it doesn't work. But you start to do that unchecked, meaning if I don't resolve it, that can become fixation. And that fixation unchecked can become non-clinical anxiety, like you're fucking panicking, you're freaking out. Or in some cases, if it's like, you talked about like life fulfillment, self-actualization. If that's something you don't manage in your life, does that become a type of phobia or anxiety in your life? So let me run through that again. Fear, a fear spike creates doubt. Doubt creates hesitation. Hesitation creates procrastination. Unchecked, that becomes fixation. Fixation or turns into non-clinical anxiety. That's a timeline. It doesn't happen right away and it doesn't dissipate right away. So the concept here, it's one of my most favorite things that I share about this, is that when you understand fear management, you actually, a bonus is you gain time management. That understanding fear management gives you the ability to manage your time. And although time is the only thing we can't regenerate, imagine if our superpower, or one of them, was our ability to manage our time effectively. So if I said to you, you know, hey, that girl you wanted to ask out and it took you 3 months and then you finally ask her out and she's going, you know, like I was going to write you off tonight. I couldn't believe you waited 3 months and, you know, but I'm leaving town tomorrow. So all we have is tonight. You're like in this romantic tragedy, you go, oh my God, we could have been hanging out for fucking 3 months. But my fear prevented me from, you know, and it's the craziest thing. And I'll give you like this. I don't know why this just popped in my head, because I'm a fear management coach. Like I've developed this system, right? I teach it at hospitals. I teach it to companies. I teach it to tier one. But way back in the day, I had this military group that we would train with once or twice a year. And it was always once or twice a year because it took 6 months to do the contract. It was like months of friggin' back and forth and meetings and sole source statements and phone calls. And then one day, seven of them showed up at one of our combatives camps. And I said, because I'd heard about it through another buddy in the industry, I said, hey, guys, like, we've been training together for like, this is going on our second year. Why aren't we doing a multi-year contract? Like, instead of doing it piecemeal each time, because it's such a pain in the ass. And then what you need to understand is, like, that's, this is how I provided for my family, right? Doing these contracts. So there was an amount of fear and stress associated with each one. Would I get the gig? Would I do the deal? You know, would it, would they get funded? So I just, not on a lark, but just on a, like, just said to the guy, hey, why don't, you know, is it possible to do a contract so we don't do it one by one? And I figured the guy would say no. This is almost like, and I'm using this date analogy. Hey, you want to go on a date? No. Okay. Just thought I'd ask, right? I go, hey, why don't we do a multi-year contract so we don't have to do this dance for 6 months? And he looks at me and he goes, yeah, that's a great idea. Let me look into that. And that was it. And then they did that. And then I trained them for 11 years until that unit was disbanded. But it was because I had the fear management skills to ask the question, because I had the idea. And I know this is kind of a weird example, but to me, it's exactly like a date. It's like, oh, like, why would they do a multi-year contract with me? Like they're doing, it was almost like, when I think about this, it was like, if they know what to do, if they wanted to do a multi-year contract with me, they'd have already suggested that.
Yeah.
But it was right. But what it was nobody had thought about it. And so if I talk to a pro athlete, you know, he's got a fear about getting sponsors, let's say. And I go, well, have you gone up and asked people what's required to get sponsored by them? No. Why? Because they want to get rejected. It's the date thing, right? But mm-hmm. all it is, you know, when I talk about, like, you know, when I'm coaching business people and I'm reminding them, you know, when you decided to become an entrepreneur and go it on your own, you know, what was the time gap between you working at the job you didn't like, realizing that you had a better way or a better idea or something you really wanted to do, and when you finally did it? It's never the next day. In other words, when someone goes, this, it could be marriage, it could be dating, it could be business, it could be violence. People go, I always say, your intuition tells you it's time to move. But our fear whispers in our ear and goes, no, no, right? And we do this with romantic relationships. We do this. How many times have you had, and this goes like everyone listening, and I've done this a bunch of times, if you're a good person, you don't like confrontations. That's normal. Mm-hmm. How many times have you had a conversation with a family member or a coworker or just a person you know, where it starts off with something like this? Hey, man, this isn't going to be easy. It's kind of uncomfortable. You know, you're fired or this or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And you finally get it off your chest. And then when it's done, you're like, oh my God, I'm so glad that's over. But what we never think about is how long we carried that weight. And it's always like, I've been meaning to have this conversation with you for 3 months, 3 years. And these are, I'm giving goofy examples. They're not so goofy, but real examples of how fear and time management are connected. And so, you know, I make this joke all the time that fear management needs new management because nobody likes talking about fear. But maybe I should just change my workshop to call, you know, time management workshop or no time, or like, I don't know, instead of no fear. Just this idea that if we looked at all the time we've wasted because we sit around going, I wonder if this, I wonder if that, I'm afraid to ask this, I don't think I should do that. And I'm not saying rumination, deliberation, right, isn't a necessary part of creation. Mm-hmm. But there comes a point where you objectively have to go, yeah, I'm not doing this because of fear, not because I don't know what to do or how to do it. This is now some sort of psychological fear that keeps pushing this to the back burner.
Yeah. Yeah, no, man, it's definitely something that can cripple you in life and on the trail. In fact, I used to know a guy. He was the editor of a magazine, and he had this saying on the trail: hesitation breeds devastation. And man, that was it. Like, if, you know, I call it that hell or high water moment, right? Like, you had to like commit 100%. And if you didn't, and you weren't just prepared to deal with the consequences, you know, you're not even thinking about them, right? But you have thought about them and you're okay with them. And it's like, all right, I'm fully committed to this move. And man, if you didn't commit 100%, like, those are the people that got hurt. And that was a big part of that, that fear management, aspect, because it's easy to let that voice whisper in your ear, but sometimes you got to know, because sometimes it's like, well, maybe that jump is too big for you, right? Like, is this fear? I think it's like rumination, like thinking about it, that's part of the process, because you do have to think about it sometimes.
All right, so we're back after some technical difficulties. Appreciate your patience.
You started to warble off. You were talking about you went from the hesitation devastation quote from one of your old mentors or coaches or buddies, and then it started to get warbly, and I started.
All right.
I got the gist of it, but I don't know if you want to kind of recap from there.
No, man. That hesitation, is something that you got to deal with and on the trail and in life. And
you said something interesting in that, and I don't know if we can save it, and who knows if the recording might be very clear, but from my end, I was losing it. But it was just this idea that there are certain jumps and certain moments that you need to commit, and that if you don't commit, that's where an injury can happen. And it's that doubt hesitation moment. So it's an interesting thing in, you know, you said, hey, like, you got to know you're ready for it. Maybe you're not ready for it. And this comes back to, you know, one of the examples I gave, that I make this joke when someone says I have, you know, I'm afraid of public speaking. And you're not afraid of speaking, and you're not afraid of speaking in public, because you're doing that with me right now and you got no problem. And they're like, oh, like, in other words, try to remind people you've got the assets and the tools and the experience. What you've done is created doubt and hesitation in your mind. And what that's doing is, and that's the acronym FEAR that we love to share: false expectations appearing real. False expectations appearing real. When I'm visualizing something negative in the future, that's impacting my concentration or my performance in the present. And that's the critical thing. So you're about to hit a jump, and, you know, you're not fucking cycling for it going, shit, do I have my bike? Is this my bike? Like, you're not worrying about if you got your bike. You're not worrying about if your feet are on the pedals. You're not worried about is this the right jump? You're visualizing, not executing something that you need to do, whether it's speed, whether it's torque, whether it's balance, whether it's where you're looking. I used to compete skiing, you know, and if you went off a jump and you fucking accidentally looked down or at a tree or at the, I mean, that totally, you were wiping out if you looked down instead of out or where you want to land. And it's no doubt it's got to be the same thing with you guys. But, you know, if I peel the onion and go, well, why would you look down? The only reason you look down is because of fear. There's something it's the pre-fight that I talk about. When my ski coach said to me, how do you feel? And I lied. If he was really a good coach, he wouldn't have given me, hey, remember gate 50, the ice is there. If he was really a good coach, he'd have noticed that I was scared shitless and I was lying. That's what I try to do with our No Fear program. Like, I work a lot with people who have the self-awareness to recognize, yeah, I am afraid of shit, you know, of different, you know, things in my life. And I want to get control of that. But I mostly work with people who train people. And you know, one of our more successful programs is this. It's in the self-defense realm, but we do this no fear training as well, because, like you pointed out, it applies to every aspect of our life. The frequency of you having a fear spike versus a violent encounter is, you know, it's ridiculous. As humans, we have fear spikes every single day. Mm-hmm. We just don't identify them or keep track of them. You know, I get up as a 61-year-old beaten up athlete. I get up, and as I get up, I'm monitoring my neck and my back when I stand up in the morning, going, you know, how's my body feel today? Well, that's a fear filter. It's like, what am I going to be able to do today? What do I have to watch out for? You know, you might have been preparing for the podcast, noticed your physiology changing. Going, I don't want this to suck. I hope my equipment doesn't fuck up in the middle. You know, like, and it creates, like last night, I don't know how this happened. I'm driving, my mom's visiting. I'm driving her home. I look down, I'm about to get on the highway, and it says, you know, 4 miles left of my gas tank. I'm like, I don't remember my alarm, like low fuel alarm going off. What the hell's going on? Did somebody borrow my car? One of the kids, whatever. But I look at that, and even though I know there's reserve underneath and hidden, and they tell you and they warn you, it still gave me an adrenaline dump. Where I was thinking, okay, where's the closest gas station? I don't want to be stuck with no gas. And yeah, it's a fear spike. It's not that I'm afraid that I can't solve the problem and I can't get an Uber to drive me to a gas. But I couldn't change the physiology that was changing in my body because I was imagining, and that's the big thing in the program. Can I improve my self-awareness that improves my critical thinking? If I do that, I improve my time management. And now that doesn't change the events I'm dealing with, but it changes how quickly I start dealing with them and how quickly I start getting strategic.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's so one of the tools that I remember you talking about, and I definitely wanted to get your thoughts on, was using breathing to, you know, help control that cycle. Because I think a big aspect you've touched on a few times, like you can't control the fear spike. Like, it doesn't make sense, right? You're like, it makes no logical sense. Why am I worried about this? You know, if I think about it logically, but I'm going to have this fear spike. And now how do I manage that? Like, how do I change my relationship with fear? And I remember you mentioning breathing being one of those things, and something that I've, you know, personally been getting more into myself and talking about more, you know, to mountain bikers about, is using breathing for that. So can you touch on how do you see breathing as fitting into the, you know, the no fear system?
Yeah. So on one of the slides in our course, I talk about this moment when you're in the fear loop where you need to just literally tell yourself to stop and recognize your breathing, like just, am I vertically breathing? Am I breathing up into my chest? I'm not getting down in nice, you know, into my belly expanding, you know, and I'm not a breathing expert. Mm-hmm. And people should do some research. And there's a few really good schools out there and really good books that they could look into. And there's some amazing apps that just guide you through the stuff. And as long as you're doing it, you know, it's, we take breathing. So let me backtrack for a second. We all take breathing for granted. Right. Mm-hmm. And especially if you're an athlete like yourself, it would never have occurred to you to do breathing exercises because you go, well, I am aerobically and anaerobically pretty fit from fucking mountain biking. Why would I do breathing exercises? Well, you can do extra stuff that would improve your aerobic and anaerobic capacity and the health of your lungs and the relationship between nose and mouth breathing. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of research around that with regard to improving sleep, which, you know, is huge for an athlete. And then there's a ton of research on helping to regulate state between parasympathetic or sympathetic. Mm-hmm. So I discovered the breathing because of a neck injury I had that impacted my trigeminal nerve and affected, like, I had facial paralysis, and I still have, you know, remnants of that. But the neck injury damaged elements of putting pressure on my vagus nerve and the face. I started just getting like friggin' anxiety. I'd have never had it out of the blue. and kind of freaks you out. And what I can honestly say helped regulate me was just doing these breathing exercises. And it took months of, you know, it's like somebody saying, oh, I just realized I'm 50 pounds overweight. Like, you know, I'd like to get this off me. You go, yeah, that might take you like a year and a half, 2 years to do it properly. Right. You know,
yeah.
What are you talking about? Well, you got to work out and you got to change your caloric intake. And you don't strike me as a person that's going to stop eating pasta and bread and cake or work out. Like, it's going to take time to do it properly. Yeah. So the same thing with the breathing. I wanted, as soon as I started to do the breathing, to be okay right away. And you could feel the changes, but you've got to train your system. So in terms of, you know, when, and it's an interesting thing because it's a horse and a cart metaphor. Like, if I talk to somebody in the breathing industry, they'll say, no, the breathing has to happen first. And I go, well, the mind controls the body. If I don't have a mental map that's explaining that I'm actually not lost right now, I'm just stuck in the fear loop, does that help me get into my breathing faster? And I think it's more of a unconscious commercial bias where, like, why would a breathing expert say, no, you got to study Tony's cycle of behavior, how to make decisions under duress first, then come to us. I just look at it as holistic, that there are times when I'll go, okay, get your breathing under control. And now where are you? What's going on? And there are times when, and a lot of it is really like the same way I teach self-defense, man. It's like, I go, what's going on? If you turn around and I'm lunging at you, you can't sit down and meditate right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'm in the wilderness and there's an animal chasing me. You know, I can't stop and call Tony and go, so listen, really quickly, what should I do? Like, you need to fucking be moving. Whereas if I say to you, hey, in 2 days, this race, it's happening here, or in 2 days, I'm going to come and kick your ass. You can get a fear spike, but you got 48 hours to figure some shit out, right? How do I avoid this? How do I diffuse this? Or how do I defend this? And, you know, those are the three D's in our system: detect, diffuse, defend. It's the same thing with the mindset stuff. So if you're in a situation where you can communicate to yourself, that internal coach, then you can tell yourself, hey, man, you know, we know if we're vertically breathing, if we're up high in our chest, we're limiting the amount of blood flow between the body, the oxygen, the blood, you know, and the brain. And that is going to impact your decision-making. And, you know, it's a whole cycle. But there's a lot of, without me, I don't want to come across as an expert on that, but there's a lot of evidence and research that proper breathing improves your sleep, improves your mood, that in a high stress situation, you can use it to change your state, to go from that sympathetic to a parasympathetic. And so in a high stress situation, when you're freaking yourself out, because, you know, part of our program, without going too deep in it, is that the fear spike always triggers some sort of visualization. And that becomes a movie in your mind, and you need to learn how to walk out of that movie or change it, because it's a movie where you're the producer, you're the director, and you've cast yourself as victim number one in your own movie.
Yeah.
As opposed to, okay, I'm gonna make this fucking jump, or I'm gonna win this, or I'm living happily ever after. Yeah, it's gonna be a roller coaster, because that's what life is, but you give yourself permission to win.
Yeah. Yeah, no, man, that's I think a really good spot to kind of start wrapping it up. I know we're approaching the hour mark there, and man, we didn't even get into the self-defense side of it, of what
if there's interest, happy to jump on another show on the self-defense. You know, honestly, like, if someone said, teach me everything you know about physical self-defense, or teach me everything you know about fear management, as much as I love the physical stuff, if you're watching this podcast, you can see I'm in my garage gym. I teach out of here 5 days a week. I've got more students online virtually than I ever had at my live school. We do amazing stuff in here, but I would tell you, you know, if you could only pick one, do the physical training or just learn my No Fear program, I would tell you the No Fear program, because the No Fear program is going to make you a better athlete. The No Fear program is going to make you a better parent. The No Fear program is going to make you a better communicator. I discovered this late in the game because it was organic and intuitive, but I didn't. And again, serendipitously, I discovered it because of my passion for teaching people how to avoid and manage violence. But you know, if you're a good Samaritan, you're probably not going to get physically touched by violence, even though many people do. Statistically, you know, many people don't. And in terms of frequency, but violence doesn't care if you're a liberal or a Republican, you know, right. Violence doesn't care if you're a mountain biker or a swimmer. You know, when it happens, it just happens. And I'm not teaching a martial art. I'm teaching people how to manage violence, how to, you know, anticipate it, how to look at it, but not in a paranoid way. Just, you know, if I said to you, you know, hey, who wants to do a first aid course? Nobody would think that'd be paranoid. If I said to you, let me teach you about defensive driving, how to be a safer driver, nobody would think that's paranoid. But if I start talking about self-defense, people are like, oh no. You know, oh, you know, yeah. I don't want to attract violence to me. It's like we teach it with the same bedside manner that EMS would teach first aid and CPR. You don't want it to happen, but here are some simple things you could do should you find yourself in that situation.
Yeah, no, that was one thing that I really liked about, I mean, there were a bunch of things. The fact that you take the physiology into account, again, I think that's something that has a lot of carry over to mountain biking, because one of the things that you know, makes me laugh is when I hear some, you know, coach share his 10 steps to cornering. And it's like, dude, when you're on the trail and you're trying to remember 10 steps, like, right, that's not going to happen, right? Like your ability to access those fine motor skills is super limited, especially in a high stress environment. And so, you know, I think that's what really kind of makes your self-defense system what you would call a real world self-defense system, is it takes that physiology from the fear spike into account and says, okay, now what can we do with this? And how can we, you know, weaponize this in our favor? And so I do think that it's something that more mountain bikers should be aware of, because in general, like you said, they are a group that tends to, I don't like the term anti-violence, because it's almost like, well, then you must be pro-violence if you study this stuff. But like you said, I think people are afraid that they'll manifest it in their life on some level if they prepare for it, which is, like you said, it's silly, because there's other areas of their life that they obviously prepare for. So I think that, you know, checking out your no fear system and your spear system and just pretty much everything that you do is something that people could benefit from on a lot of different levels.
Yeah. And I agree. And listen, you know, if people thought of self-defense as just, you know, another survival modality that, you know, you don't put your seatbelt on hoping to get in a car accident to test the theory that seatbelts save lives. Right. But
right.
Like you're also not defined about putting it on. You're not like, God, I hate that you put your seatbelt on. And I've tried different ways to explain that, you know, like our one day Be Your Own Bodyguard course, the most important part of it is understanding the fear and understanding the avoidance. There was somebody actually at the seminar that we met at who just shared with me that, you know, she was out, you know, just hiking with some friends and they accidentally went onto somebody's private property. You know, you're out in the wilderness and this couple came down like freaking out on them, like scary threats of violence over, hey, you know, we're having a picnic on your property. We didn't realize, like, hey man, we didn't know this was private property. We were walking along the river and just got here by accident. You don't know when something's going to kick off. You know, you're driving and somebody's in your blind spot and you turn, you know, you don't know what's going on in that person's car, in their life. they're suddenly over the top. You're at a restaurant, you're, you know, and it's horrible to think about this, but if you think about anybody who's ever been touched by violence, didn't go out that night going, you know, I hope like a big fight breaks out in the bar right beside me and I get drawn into this, or I hope this active shooter happens at this place that I'm at, because that'd be a real interesting experience to have. Nobody fucking thinks that. I abhor violence. I want to let me share that to, you know, you're outdoors in nature. So, you know, I get that. I love that. But I abhor violence, which is why I studied. I was so afraid of violence as a kid that I realize now that's why I was glued to those fighting shows, is because a subconscious fear of mine was somehow tied to, I don't know what to do in a violent encounter. And I don't know why I was obsessed with that as a kid. But, you know, I look back now on the journey of my life. Here I am, 61. Watching those shows when I was 6, 7, 8 years old, that for 50 years, understanding how to avoid and manage violence has been part of my consciousness. But I mean, look at the work that we've done from training tier one operators all the way down to, you know, mountain bikers, right?
So yeah, exactly.
It's just good humans that don't want bad shit to happen. That's all.
That's it. No, that is totally it. It's like, it's being prepared. It's not about being paranoid. And, right. You know, and to be honest, one of the things that's inspired me as well is like, you know, I may not personally need it, but I may help someone, like someone listening to this podcast may end up, you know, getting involved with, you know, with what you're doing and then be able to use that. And they wouldn't have been involved. They wouldn't have known it would have existed if it wasn't for me trying to share this. So, you know, it's maybe you aren't the one who's able to use these skills, but maybe somehow you're able to pass these skills on in some way to someone who is able to use the skills. And I think when you think about it that way, you almost have some sort of responsibility, not only to yourself, but to society, to your fellow man, to have these skills and be able to utilize them and pass them on. So yeah, that's why I really, you know, commend you for what you're doing. And I know that you're impacting lives on a huge level on a bunch of different areas. So, so cool. So I will include the links to everything, but I know, you know, nofearnow.com is your no fear site. And then you've also got the blowertrainingsystems.com. Like I said, I know I've got a couple other links that I'll share, but any other websites or anything that you want to mention that people check out?
I know that we've got our, you know, the free ebook on fear, which is really fantastic. You should have a link to that.
Yep. I'll share that link.
Yeah. Because that one's like an 8 or 9 page ebook. And I tried to make it as short as possible. But it really, I make a joke about that ebook, Making Friends with Fear. You know, I've had people go, why didn't you write a whole book? I go, well, because you probably wouldn't have read it if it was like 190 pages long or something. Mm-hmm. You know, when they were creating the, you know, the online PDF funnel to try and get people to purchase the No Fear stuff, they went, oh, we just need like a one page, like, you know, 5 things you need to know. And I fucking hate that type of advertising, right? It's so bullshit. And so I sat there and, you know, like, me educating people is how I feed my family. So I'm not going to shy, like hide the fact that I want you to buy the No Fear program and learn it. And I would love every one of your listeners to hire me to come into their company and talk, whether virtually or live. But when they're creating it, they said, hey, we just need one page. I started writing, and then like 3 days, hey, when's that coming? And I wrote for like 2.5 weeks and condensed it to 9 pages. They said, this is too long. I said, this is how long it is. Because I wanted it to be a standalone. I wanted somebody to be able to read that and go, wow. Because a lot of us don't realize that we're figuring it out. But if somebody just can put it in words for us, it's like flipping the light switch on.
Yeah.
And so if I can, you know, like you had a bunch of epiphanies at the seminar, we went, oh, fuck. And you like, and that created momentum in your mind. which created momentum in your body. And now you might coach differently, talk differently, just from hearing like a couple of cool concepts. So yeah, it's like you said, man, somebody will listen to this and they go, I'm already a fear management expert. This guy's, I don't need him. And somebody else will go, holy shit. It's like, I was starving for this. This was like music to my ears. Give me more. And then, I loved what you said. Like, you may listen to this, like a lot of the people who know who I am are military, law enforcement, martial artists. And they go, oh, I'm a fan of Tony's, but I don't need that stuff. I'm already an expert, but I like listening to him talk about it. Well, guess what? Your wife or your brother or your kid or somebody else in your life who isn't a martial art fanatic is more vulnerable than you.
Yep.
And maybe you can pass this on to them.
So, yeah. No, I totally agree, man. I come from the jiu-jitsu community as well. I've been doing jiu-jitsu for the last 8 years. And I will say, like, one of the things that I feel everybody should do jiu-jitsu, but there's almost like an attitude of like, well, if you're not going to do jiu-jitsu, then you get nothing.
Right.
And it's like, well, I don't believe that that's the best attitude, right? Like, hopefully we should have something that we can give to people who aren't fanatics and aren't like really heavily into this stuff that is usable. Like I said, man, that's why I really like what you're doing, because you're making it accessible to just regular people who don't necessarily want to make this a centerpiece of their life, but hopefully maybe they get inspired to, you know, take up jiu-jitsu or join your garage gym program, or, you know, it starts to become more of a lifestyle for them than just a, you know, one day thing. But man, shoots, we got to start somewhere. And I can't recommend to people enough, you know, starting with you and your stuff if they don't have anywhere else to go. So
I appreciate that. I remember, like, our courses and our programs are taught with the bedside manner and efficiency of that little tactical first aid course. You know, you're not a paramedic, you're not a brain surgeon. You're just, hey, here's how you put on a tourniquet. You know, here's how you do CPR. Here's how you do. And that's what we're looking at. We're not teaching people how to box in a day or how to do jiu-jitsu in a day. Or it's like, it's just changing your self-awareness, which changes your situational awareness, which improves your safety. And it's that simple. And that, truth be told, you know, if you're doing jiu-jitsu for 8 years, you would learn something. Like, you came to the course, you realize that if you grapple every day of your life for 8 years, the myelin in your brain that's wrapped around the neurons is predisposing you to grapple.
Mm-hmm.
You get jumped by one guy and you go, I'll take this fucker to the ground and I'll choke him out. And then while you're doing that, you know, the back doors open of a car and three of his friends come out. You're on the ground with one guy wrapped up where you should have been on your mountain bike riding.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, and I'm not saying this because you mentioned jiu-jitsu, it's the same flaw with boxing, the same flaw with taekwondo, the same flaw with, if all you know how to do is use your gun, then everything needs to be solved with a gun. You don't have any problem with de-escalation. You don't have any situational awareness skills. And so that's where we approach it, is what is holistic. And the last thing I'll say about it is, and it's been this way since I started teaching in the 80s, is it moral? Is it ethical? Is it legal? Right? And your decision-making loop needs to run through those three filters for you to be a good human.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I think that's a great spot to leave it for our listeners. So I really appreciate your time. Like I said, I'll put the links up so people can check out your stuff, and highly encourage everybody to check out that free ebook as well. But thank you for your time.
Okay, buddy. Good to see you again. And I'll be back in your area in October. So if you're around, we'll be announcing another course soon. So hopefully we'll see you there.
Excellent, man. Yeah, that'll be great. You probably can plan on seeing me there. So cool. All right. Well, let me stop the recording here and...